Anyway, thank you for coming out. I want to talk to you about a hacker looks at 50, if you can believe that. I mean, that's kind of scary because you figure, okay, in the grand scheme of life, you're hoping that this is like halftime, and then it's not the two-minute warning. You know, buddy of mine says maybe you're in sudden death. So, see, enough of the football metaphors. Hopefully it's not too bad. So anyway, what I want to do is talk to you a little bit about what security was like back in the old days and some of the things I've learned over the years. Because one of the things that's very hard to come by is wisdom. Where does wisdom come from? Mistakes and mentors. Okay? Mentors are people who are going to try to share with you the wisdom they figured out. The problem is wisdom has a diode. It cannot be taught. It can only be learned. And if you think about it, all the lessons that you finally figured out, they've always been there. You just have chosen not to accept them. And the hard part is to go ahead and listen to some of the words of wisdom and say, you know what, I don't like that, I don't want to agree with it, but if the person really does care about you, and they seem to have some amount of wisdom in their life, then it's probably a good idea to listen to it. So I'm going to try to share a little bit of that. And I added that qualification down there on the CISSP, CISM, CISA, my alphabet soup, because yes, indeed, I am now a card-carrying member of the organization in America, the only one that I know of that's more liberal than Barack Obama, and that's AARP. Whose sole purpose is that if you've strung together 65 birthdays in a row, you deserve the contents of the United States Treasury to be given to you in benefits. So we'll see how that works out. Anyway, these guys are scary because I started getting all this mail like a couple months beforehand. I finally figured out who stole the VA laptop with 125 million names. It's AARP, and that's how they know how to go ahead and get you on schedule. So anyway, my first introduction to computers was a long, long time ago, back in 1973. We're at Amherst Central High School outside of Buffalo, New York. And you imagine I had a whole lot of things to do in Buffalo, New York, because you got, well, two seasons, winter and the 4th of July. So you spend a lot of your time indoors because it's, you know, very cold and a lot of snow out there. Well, they wheeled these two big computers into our high school. And we're trying to figure out what these things are. They were gigantic 2741s. Anybody old enough to remember an IBM 2741, what that thing was? What was that? Well, no, I didn't say what was I saying. I was saying answer my question. You know? I'll eat your sandwich. IBM 2741. Big selector typewriter and about 50 pounds of gear. I mean, it was huge, and it would chunk, and it'd tap out at about 110 baud. But the cool thing was is that you could have an acoustic coupler. Remember those things? Phone, you dial a number, put it in there, and you dial up. Came with no manuals, no README, no help button, no F1 on the keyboard. There it is. Go figure it out. And so being kids, we started figuring things out, and we started to play with it and started working out. It was pretty neat because back then, there was no internet. There were no cell phones, thank God. No email, no text messaging. A whole lot of things that we depend upon today just didn't exist. So we had to do the strangest thing in the world, and that was talk face-to-face to other people, which is a communication skill I think is getting lost. 2 months ago, I had a chance to be the guest speaker at an Eagle Scout installation dinner. About 70 of these kids came by, you know, really sharp kids, 13 to 17 years old, who achieved quite a bit. Four of them looked me in the eye. All the rest came up like this. You know, they have big thumbs. But they kind of lost that interpersonal contact. So that's an important thing to be able to talk to people. So I hope you don't lose that. So anyway, the point is what I say is that a lot of the stuff we did back then is the same as what you can do today. It's just a lot slower. But the principles are the same. And you're going to hear some of the stories here. They're going to sound a little bit familiar to you. Okay, because with this old dial-up thing, we had a program language called APL. Anybody ever heard of APL? All right, what does APL stand for? A programming language. Pretty cool. And if you can believe it, this T-shirt fit me in high school. This is my APL is taking over. Anybody recognize the symbol in the middle? See if you really truly know what APL is. What's it called? Anyone? Turn it this way. It's not an iPod. Going? Quote quad. All right, yeah, that's for alphanumeric input. Way to go. I've had that T-shirt longer than, well, actually not longer than you've been alive, but longer than everybody else has been alive here. Anyway, it's pretty cool. And so what happened is we had this APL, and it was pretty cool because what it ran, it was an interpretive language, and it ran on the IBM System 370, and there's one of them for the whole Western New York area, all the high schools dial in. We figured like, you'd send messages back and forth to kids in other high schools that are like so far away, like 15 miles or 20 miles, you know, they're beyond bicycle range. And so therefore, you could never meet them except through, well, the precursor of the internet, which is our little message system. Well, anyway, what happened is as we got a chance to go learn about the system, you figured out what you want to do. Well, what does everybody want to do to a computer system? Own it, right? Not porn. I know he's right, but, you know, take, yeah. Yeah, take away porn and role-playing games, what you got left? Nothing, right, for your life. So anyway, we figured, like, well, we'd love to own this thing. Well, the problem is that you really don't have a chance to go ahead and build rootkits back then, but you had to rely on some other way to go ahead and attack the system. Remember, this is a System 370, big, gigantic thing, size, well, not quite the size of this room, but huge. Ton of air conditioning equipment, and it works in a big glass room, and the only way in and out is to wear a white lab coat and four different colored pens. And then you knew you were one of them. So how do you penetrate that great exterior security, the physical security, to get in there and actually get to the console and run it? Field trips. And so one of the things we had is our freshman year, our sophomore year, field trip out there. And so what we did is we said, okay, fine, we got to go ahead, and because we thought our little computer was like this whole thing. Turns out, no, it's just like one of the little things running on this whole timeshare system. But to us, it was the whole universe. Okay, so, you know, the little blue pill, red pill thing. Well, we figured, all right, well, we're inside this little world. But we found where the console was. It was sitting over in the corner, and it was unattended. So, of course, we already had this set up. So one of the guys went over and kind of looked interested at the disk drives and the tapes back and forth. And one of us kind of like wandered over. And, like, there it is. Well, it's all printout, right? It's a fanfold of paper. So we're kind of, like, leafing our way back up, trying to find out the login from the morning. And there it is. On APL, all the login IDs were numeric. And so I'm thinking, like, oh, there it is. It's, I got to remember this, 3, 14, 15, 9. 3, 14, 15, 9. 3, 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, 9. Okay? And that was the root user ID. It was Pi. It's like, cool. And we got the password. So we wanted to come back. And we figured, okay, this is pretty cool. Try to get back in there, log in, number in use. Okay, it doesn't work. Why? Because you can only be logged in once. So now you have a problem that you got to go out and figure out how to get in before the operator. What do we call that today? Race condition, right? You're trying to go ahead and get into the system before this legitimate user, which means you had to show up earlier and earlier to school. And finally, one morning we got in, we logged in, we got in as the system operator, we got the password, and just sat there. And we're like, wait a minute, where's our prompt? You know, where's it getting, you know, keyboard's locked up. We didn't realize that the system operator console is always locked until you hit the equivalent like the escape key. They call it the attention key, so you could send messages, receive messages all the time. So we kind of sat there for a minute or two. The operator tried to log in. He got a number in use, realized he'd been owned, changed the password. Okay, so we're out of luck for 3 more months, so we get the next field trip out there. Fortunately, that worked again. They didn't have very good passwords. It used to be third, and then they changed it to fifth. I imagine we might have missed one in between, okay, but... again, bad passwords were all the rage back in the 70s. Some people just never grew out of them. And so what do we come out of there is that we want to figure out, okay, once you own the system, how do we go ahead? We've got to come up with some way to get the system operator to run a program. Well, all the regular software, you know, it's nothing special about it. But we did read something in one of these little APL journals about one of these control characters, little I-beams or dyadic I-beams. And it basically, an I-beam was an overstrike, like a little T and an upper one. And that allowed you to get system information, user ID, time of connect, things like that. But there are special I-beams that would privilege accounts, that would add and allocate space to your account, that would delete accounts, that would add them. And so we figured, like, well, this is cool because we can't run the system commands. But if we could come up with the primitive operator and get the operator to run it, it would then privilege us. What do we call that? You write a little software program, you try to get someone else to run it because it's going to do something good for you. Trojan Horse, yeah. So we wrote wonderful Trojan Horse game programs. We had the best tic-tac-toe and everything else. Didn't have any porn in it because it was all ASCII, but... there was ASCII porn, but we didn't understand that. Hey, this is Buffalo, okay? There's not much to do up there but hockey and shovel. So anyway, what happened is we figured, okay, there's one of these manuals. And IBM manuals... somebody brought this to me yesterday. You hear? I'm drawing a blank on your name. It's an old guy thing. System 370 Principles of Operation. I mean, this is a classic. And you take a look in there. It's all kind of the old EBCDIC. It's not ASCII. And this is pretty cool. Anyway, this manual that instructed everything how to run the system was not available. You couldn't order it from IBM because it began with an L, licensed material. And licensed material you're not allowed to keep because it's property of IBM forever. So anyway, like Ray Clark decides to run down, and he says, hey, I'm going to go down to IBM Buffalo and try to get one. He says, how are you going to do that? He says, I'm going to go ask for it. You got to be kidding me. So Ray, he's like a junior, I guess, a sophomore, rides his bicycle down to Buffalo, walks into the front office and says, I need a copy of this manual. You know, LY20 delivery. And they say, like, well, that's licensed material. We can't give that to you. He says, well, I want to talk to Dr. Ken Iverson. Well, Ken Iverson is like a senior fellow at IBM. He's the guy who invented this language. And he's in Armonk, New York at some high-level meeting, and he's, you know, just sitting there pounding out. And you talk to Dr. Iverson. So they call over to Armonk, world headquarters for IBM. Yeah, we got some kid here that says he wants to talk to you. He says, what does he want? He says, he wants a copy of the manual. Give him the damn manual. It's like, okay, it rocks. So one of my observations in life, just ask. And he came back with this thing. It's like, cool. It's like the user manual for it. So we wrote all these things and things like that. Unfortunately, we couldn't really get the operators to go ahead and, you know, they were too busy doing other things. And they kind of got onto us. I mean, hey, you're 15 years old. You're trying to convince somebody who's at least, what, twice your age to run something. But we started doing stuff and we could mess with it because we learned out that you could get things just by asking. And then what we did is I remember one time I was in, and the account numbers were all numeric. And, you know, the first five digits were your school user ID. Ours was 16504, and junior high was 16525, and other schools were that. And the last three digits were, like, random. But we all know that there's no such thing as random numbers in computers, right? They're pseudo-random. What do you need for pseudo-random? A seed to start out. Well, guess what seed they used to generate the pseudo-random numbers that were used for the account sequence? The system default. So one of the times I was sitting there playing around, and I type in, give me 1,000 random numbers from 1,000 to 1,000, So I'm like scanning down this whole list. Remember, it's all printed out now. You can't just put it on the screen. And I start noticing, because I knew the three user accounts that belong to our public account were 909, 094, and 061, were the last three digits. And sure enough, there they were, buried in the sequence. And I go, wait a minute, what about this one? Hey, there's mine. Well, here's one that I don't recognize. Let's try it. Brand new account, never been used. Whoa. Can I get like a little adrenaline rush, like you've got the entire book of everything. I tried another one. Well, it didn't quite work, but it was off just slightly, but it worked pretty well. And just then, the computer club advisor, Mr. Berg, walks in. He's like, hey, how are you guys doing? He's like, oh, we got this whole printout. You're trying to cover it up. Yeah, nothing going on. You know, move along. Nothing here. Because, you know, you're trying to log into all these different schools and things like that because we figured out the sequence. Well, it turned out we were off just a little bit because it wasn't, I did like 999 question mark 999 trying to be intelligent, figuring they would use like the 1,000. Well, they did 1,000 question mark 1,000. So that's why a couple were off. It was very, very slightly off. But we got about 85% of the user IDs for all the high schools around Western New York. And so even though it wasn't perfect, don't wait for perfection. Just run with it. So we owned them. We owned schools all in places we haven't even heard of before. And that was pretty cool. And so then we figured, okay, great. We own our high school. We own all the other high schools. But is that enough? No! Total global domination. Well, at least as far as we can reach on our little acoustic coupler. Well, the problem was the telephone was only set up for dialing like 5. You know, it was an internal line. You dialed 9, beep, 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 beep. You couldn't get out. You dialed 0, and of course you got the operator. And when you're a kid, you didn't want to talk to the operator because you're sure they're going to tell your mom. Like somehow operators and moms talk when you're not paying attention, and you're going to get in trouble. And mom's going to be sitting there like, you dialed 0, didn't you? So we dialed like 1, doesn't work. Then we dialed 8, and we got like this really weird dial tone. It's like, whoa, maybe it's an outside line. So we tried calling home, and beep, 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 beep. Okay, it's blocked. Well, after a little while, we figured, like, okay, well, you got to try some different numbers. So we figured, what's the first number? Let's try something. Let's try dial 1. Dial 1-1. 1-1-1. Click. Ooh. There's a sequence there. Nothing happened, but something happened. 1-1-2. 1-1-3. 1-1-4. What are we doing here? We're dialing. Well, Matthew Broderick was still in diapers. And all of a sudden, we dial, like 1-4-3 and get another dial tone. Cool. And now we dial a number. And you get, like, time and temperature. Whoa, this thing really does work our way out. And so we kind of mapped out this whole space, and we found out that we could, like, call all over the place. So I figured, like, well, this is pretty neat. Well, one of the times my parents were there down in Florida for vacation. They had 6 kids. Okay, you need a vacation when you got 6 kids. And we never traveled very far. My first time on an airplane was heading off to college, going off to Northwestern, the great western part of America, all the way to Western Chicago. Okay, you know, I had a small world there in Buffalo. So I was like, Mom and Dad are down in Florida. Remember back then, long distance was expensive, so you only could call on the weekends if you had to call somebody because the rates were high during the day. So I'm like, call Mom. She's down there visiting. Hello? Hi, it's Mark. What's wrong? Did something happen to the baby? Like, no, we're just calling up and say hello. No, does the house burn down? You know, the car, you know, it's like, oh, you know, you never call during the day, during the week, unless something like grandma died. Or like, no, everybody's fine. It's like, okay, this is a bad idea. Sorry, Mom, I gotta go to class. Bye. Like, this never happened. So we realized that, oh, even though you have the capability, there's sometimes not a good idea to use it. Okay, so anyway, we started trying all these things, and then we got into the mainframes at the University of Buffalo, and we got into other mainframes and systems like that. But kind of the hacker ethic back then, what's the hacker ethic say that we understand it today? Hack everything, right. Well, back then it was kind of two simple rules. Cause no damage and don't take anything that doesn't belong to you, which is tough to do today. But back then there were no legal enforcements. None of this stuff had any laws written for or against it. It was just like the wild, wild west on the internet. So we kind of all self-regulated. It was a little like small town America where you could leave your car keys under the mat and you could never have to lock your front door. And it was okay. Now we've urbanized the internet, and of course you got to lock your door, take your keys, set the bar alarms and things like that, and get big barking dogs to come in there and grab people. So we figured, like, well, okay, fine, we got all this stuff. And it was pretty neat. So we figured out that once you logged into the system, that they had to run the accounting because it was timeshare. So when you logged out, it said use this many time of Connect and use this much time of CPU. Well, we didn't want somebody that we never met to get charged for it. Well, anyway, remember we talked about user ID numbers? How do we get those? Well, first of all, the one account that we use it for the summer because of the Erie County Fair, and they let us use the Poughkeepsie, New York one. And they had, if you can believe it, in all the universe of numbers, you go all the way up to here, they used four-digit logins. And the last two are 00 or 01. Okay, that kind of cuts it down a little bit, and they didn't use passwords. How long does it take for you to figure out a user ID? But the real question was, how could you figure out a user ID and not let them get billed for it? How do you get around the billing system? And it turned out, remember that old thing I said, because the operator, if the control thing was locked and you had to hit attention to get a message, it turns out that you could get forced off the system when they went to do the backups. They bounce everybody off the system. Okay, we do that in Unix right now. You know, we bounce everybody off the system, we shut down. Well, the bounce takes effect as soon as you get control back from the carriage return. So if you're typing out a line of text, it'll get to the end of the text. And then it says, brr, bounce, bing, 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 and it logs you out. Well, what if you had like a really long line of text? Could you have a line of text that was longer than the patience of the operator? Because he wants to run his backup and go home. Well, what's the longest line that you can print? Given the fact that we had a 32K workspace, that's storage and execution, by the way. That's the total amount we had. Well, it turned out that the binary representation of information, how many bits does it take to represent a 0 or a 1? Really only one bit. As compared to 2 bytes or for letters or things like that. So if you type 200,000 zeros, that still fit within 32K. And if you took the type ball off so it wouldn't use up all your precious paper and your ribbon, it'd go brrr, 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 and it's 2 minutes to six, 1 minute to six, and the late bus leaves at six, and you don't get the late bus. You got to walk all the way home. I missed a lot of dinners in high school. And then all of a sudden the thing would stop because the guy gave up. He just like shut down the system, which meant anybody that was still logged in, their accounting data never got captured. And so nobody ever got billed for it, and we kind of kept our record clean. We figured, okay, good, no one knows we're here. We're using these little back doors. This is pretty neat, and off we go. And oh, we're doing this stuff. We get better and better like that. So what are we doing? We're learning our skills. We're trying to become a master, a ninja master, whatever you want to be, but it takes a lot of time. Okay? And unfortunately, back in the 70s, being a computer geek was not cool. We didn't dress in black. We dressed in corduroys and button-down shirts, and we really, really did, at least I really did, wear a pocket protector and birth control glasses. I didn't tape them. I didn't have to. I never dropped them because, what, do sports? Like, I was like this skinny, geeky kid. I actually did go out for sports. I made one varsity team that was wrestling in 9th grade. I was 5'3". I weighed 97 pounds. And I won the majority of my matches by default. No other high school had somebody my size. Hey, any way you can do it. And in 10th grade, I became 6'1". And I grew 10 inches in a year and a half, and my arm that I thought was about this long, all of a sudden, was about that long. And you go to shoot a basketball, and it goes over the top, and you know, hits on the third row of the bleachers, and you're like, you're this awkward geek for a while. It's terrible. Eventually, you figure out the new dimensions, the new laws of physics, but it's a tough time. You know, everybody says you don't want to go back and repeat adolescence. I can understand that. Besides, we couldn't find porn. The only porn we ever found was when Chris Gronkowski brought some Playboys on a Boy Scout camp out. And my dad was a scoutmaster, and he confiscated them. Then I found out he kept them. Dad? Well, I didn't keep them at home, but anyway. So we had to do something like that. And so what we wanted to do is we wanted to do all this stuff. So we figured, well, what can we do? Well, that summer, after high school, senior year, it's like really tough job market. Because remember back in the 70s, things weren't going very well. Bethlehem Steel, you remember? Nobody remembers this. Nobody remembers. President Gerald Ford, with inflation and stagflation, came up with a program to help whip inflation now. And what does this program involve? Buttons. Absolutely.
That was good.
Would you like an iPood? Courtesy of Jinx. There you go. What did the button say? Win. Like Schwartau, right? Without the extra N. Whip inflation now. And the Bethlehem Steel plant in Buffalo had shut down, and Bell Aerospace shut down, and Chevy shut down. And all the major manufacturing plants shut down. We had unemployment in the mid-20 percentiles. Okay? Horrible economy. Things are going lousy. Everybody's desperate to get a job. I got a job at the corner grocery store as a night manager 3 nights a week. That was pretty cool, getting paid minimum wage, $2.30 an hour. But we knew that one high school student per year got hired as a summer job to go work at the Board of Cooperative Educational Services, or BOCES, which administered all the computer stuff. And so I said, well, you know, I went to my high school advisor. I said, well, I'd like to talk to them. He says, well, that's kind of a coincidence. They want to talk to you. It's like, why? Well, they know all the stuff you've been doing. It's like, but since we haven't damaged anything, you know, it's not like we hurt anybody. So they said, well, you got these kids doing all this stuff, and like they own the boxes, but they're not destroying anything. So I went there, interviewed, got the job. So one of the first things I did is I made myself public enemy number one for all the other hackers in Western New York, because I came up with a really good pseudo-random number generator sequence for each of the school, went to four-digit sequence instead of three, re-randomized everything, locked all the accounts, and did a whole bunch of other security stuff. All the stuff I'd wanted to do for 3 years, and I'm root, I own the box, I'm doing the stuff, and I do it 8 hours a day, and I'm getting paid for it. $2.10 an hour, because it was the state of New York and they get paid below minimum wage. And so I have a legitimate W-2 doing computer security work full-time for 1976 for $2.10 an hour. Have we come a long way or what? Okay? Well, one of the things we did that senior year is we went ahead in 1975 is there's a really cool publication called Popular Electronics. And on the cover of the January 1975 edition, they had this new device called the Altair. The Altair was really basically the whole first home computer you could build. Yeah, there's some argue that the other stuff, but basically it came in a kit. The Altair 8800, like, whoa, this is pretty neat. So we got a bunch of kids from different high schools together. It was like $300. I mean, my paper route, for real, paid 1.8 cents for a daily and like 5.2 cents for a Sunday. And that's how much you made delivering newspapers. And so at the end of the week, you get up there, snow, fire, rain, flood, whatever. You had to go deliver papers. And you end up with like $11 at the end of the week. But that was kind of good money back then. So how are we going to go with $300? So we pooled our resources, multiple high schools, and we bought one of these Altairs. And you open it up, and it's in a box, and it's just full of parts. And there's one chip. Everything else, resistors, diodes, capacitors, and you need a hell of a lot of solder. So we figured, okay, let's go. So we broke up into teams. We started soldering things, and we put the board together. And then once you did the board, and you figured it out, and you double-checked it, you sent the board on to the next kid. And then he double-checked all your solder, make sure you didn't have cold solder joints, and you went on. And we did this, and it took us about a month and a half, and we finally got all these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of parts all put together in this little thing. We put it all together. We went over to Tom Richmond's house, because Tom was a senior. And we were like, okay, guy, this guy's big. He's 17. Plus, he had, facial hair. That was pretty cool back then. See, all you guys eat McDonald's today, all this growth hormone, so you get facial hair at 12. But back then, you had to work for it. And so we came over to Tom, went down his basement. Okay, we're set up down there. I think it was on the ping pong table. And we got the computer ready to put in the big chip. Anybody remember what chip was in there? Z80 chip? Yeah, the Z80 chip. And we take this thing out. Of course, danger. It could be damaged by static electricity. We don't want any of that. So we took a wire. We tied one end of it around the sewer pipe in the basement, the other end around Tom's wrist. Okay, this guy was grounded. He got hit with lightning. Okay, he's grounded. And Tom takes this chip and ever so gently sets it and seats it in there. We stand back and we turn it on. And it doesn't work. And it just sits there. And the lights aren't moving, and it doesn't respond. Because the I.O. back then was little lights on the front and little switches, and you programmed it in binary. Well, we're like, oh, my God, there's like 1,000 different things that go wrong here. What could it be? And then little Billy Richmond, who was still in junior high school, a little roly-poly kid with a big frizzy hair, bing, 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 hey, you guys, what you doing? Hey, what's that? Oh, look at that big thing in the middle. You know, it's not pushed in. He reaches in with his thumb. And we all like slow motion. No! And the chip wasn't seated, right? And that was the problem. It worked perfectly. So Billy lived. Well, what do we do with this thing? I said it got a little I.O. interface. Pretty simple. So you program it with switches. 10010100 load 01001010110110110 load. And it would take a long time to load a program. We started with 4K. Extra memory was, you had to buy that. So once you crush, you programmed it, and it ran. Your I.O., you just read the little lights. And it was all in not hex, octal. You translate it, okay, 712, and you bring up the words and things like that. But it ran. And so we figured, okay, what can we do with this stuff? Well, one of the guys was really smart. Well, the next year actually got the Junior Achievement Invention of the Year Award. Nationally, came up with a little I.O. device. It was basically a keyboard. And was using the equivalent of a touch-tone pad and a little LED display that we could key stuff in. So now we had I, we had O. This is pretty cool. And we also figured out a way that if we could go do this something, we could go ahead and show it off at a school assembly. And we found out in a little article that we read someplace in the magazine that if you played a certain sequence of no-ops in the right order, it would create a little RF transmission. If you held an AM radio next to the chip, you could make go dee 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 doo dee or whatever you wanted to. So we took this thing to the school assembly and made it play music. And that was our highest and best use. This is the same device that Bill Gates looked at and said, Microsoft. No, by the way, we did write a 4K BASIC. I wrote the long divide routines. We wrote the stuff. And this is what Woz and Jobs looked at and said, Apple. And they wrote the little I.O. device that we did. But what did they have that we didn't have? Vision. And what did they end up with that we didn't have? Billions. Not that I'm bitter. But vision is important. Vision is everything. If you don't have vision for your life, you're following somebody else's vision. If you don't know what you want to do, you're going to be doing what someone else wants you to do. And so we had in our hands Apple and Microsoft, but we didn't have the vision. We're a couple years younger than those guys, but not that much. And so we all went on. We went off to colleges, and we dispersed. We all got, and we never came back again. Well, here's the point, is I want to go ahead and I want to get into someplace. Well, my problem is we got six kids. I found my dad's old tax return from 75, made $14,300. I don't know how we ate, but we did. We had a lot of spaghetti. We wore clothes that belonged to our cousins. We thought everybody wore hand-me-downs. And then, you know, your brothers, we had four girls, so everything passed along. We did okay. When you're a kid and you don't have the internet, you don't know if you're poor or not, so you're just happy because we had a pretty good family. Well, I wanted to go to something other than like University of Buffalo and take the bus into school because you knew if you lived at home, you'd have to drive all the kids to, you know, be babysitting and things like that. And, oh, by the way, I credit Mom with helping me wake up very early and very easy in life. Why? Because she used to, you know, come home from school or whatever. You want to go take a little nap before you go out and do stuff. Hey, Mark. Yeah. You going to babysit tonight? Yeah, all right, fine, sure. Well, all of a sudden you get up in the morning, you're ready to help the door. Think, where are you going? I said, well, you promised you'd babysit. Oh, yeah. Well, now I can wake up like that anytime. Came in very handy later in life. So thank you, Mom. But anyway, I wanted to go ahead and I wanted to apply for stuff. So how do you get money? I had no money for college, so I figured, okay, let's apply for things. So all these little things, you take the PSAT, you score high enough, they send you all these little admission stuff. And then all these ROTC things. I mean, I don't know about ROTC. My dad was in the Army. He used to tell me stories about how he was in the Korean War, and he was a hero, and you see a little scar in his leg, and that was a bullet hole, and he rescued all these guys. And later I found out that's where he cut himself with a lawnmower when he was a kid. And he had spent his time at Fort Halliburton, Maryland. He never got anywhere near Korea, but that's okay. When you're a kid, you believe this stuff. And like being the geeky kid I was, I never learned to swim until I was like 13 or 14, so I was scared to death of the Navy because, you know, you look at the war movies, these guys jumping over the side and they get torpedoed. Like, no way I'm doing that. Well, it turned out, you know, I got all these ROTC things, the Navy moved fastest. And I said, all right, well, I need money, went in for an interview. So I remember December 1975, went down to the Navy processing station in Buffalo, New York, did my weigh-in, 6'2", 131 pounds. According to the little nomogram, I had -4% body fat. I was pulling a 28-inch vacuum up here, okay? And I went in for the interview, and lo and behold, remember I mentioned that summer job we did over at the Erie County Fair where we were showing how kids can use computers? Well, it turned out right next to us back then was the Navy. And here's the same Navy lieutenant, the recruiter. It's like, I know you. I know you. Interview went really great. Thank you very much. Extra quarter in the collection plate on Sunday. And I got a nice little letter in the mail from the Navy saying, we're sorry, but you did not earn a scholarship, but we will keep your name on a wait list. All right, so it looks like it's living home. But I didn't give up. And I kept trying, and I went going, and finally got a letter saying, congratulations, you cleared the wait list. You've got a scholarship, 4 years paid to Northwestern University. And I'm going, great. I never applied to Northwestern University because that was my first choice. My first choice was MIT, and I didn't get in. So I was going to like, hey, why not? Shoot for the moon. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. But keep trying. Basically, never disqualify yourself. There are people out there that will disqualify you. There are people who love to disqualify you. But don't do it to yourself. If you're too old, apply for it anyway. If you're not rich enough, apply for it anyway. If you don't have the time and experience, if they want a CASSP, MOUSE, and you don't have one yet, apply for the job anyway. Because you know what? You still might get it. And more often than not in life, I found out that when I've asked for things that the rules said you can't have, I get them. Because most people disqualify themselves. Well, I can't do that. I'm not smart enough. I don't have the certifications. I never finished my degree. On. Well, the nice thing is about having a college education paid for by the Navy is that you could, like, have a lot of fun. Plus, my high school is pretty cool. They had all these advanced placement courses, and I took all these years of German. And when I got there, they were trying to do like language placement. Well, the problem was with Herr Fies. I mean, we could really easily distract Herr Fies. He was from Buffalo, and he spoke like "Ich bin ein German Berliner," you know, very hard Buffalo German, and very easy to distract. And it's like, "Hey, Herr Fies, tell us that time again where you took this cow up the stairs in college." "Oh, yeah, that was a good one." And, you know, there goes the German lesson for the day. So the problem with that is when you show up in college, they want you to take this college-level admissions to see can you get credit for 2 years of German, because you needed that at Northwestern to get your degree from the Arts and Sciences School. Well, guess what? I got lost. I could not find whatever the building was. When I finally showed up, it was like half an hour into the exam. It's like, "Oh, geez." So I went back to the register or whatever, and they said, "Well, let's look at your grades." "Well, they actually look pretty good, you know, all A's and B's, so yeah, we'll give you credit." So I got 6 quarter credits for German. I took AP English and math and chemistry, and they gave me credit for that. They gave me credit for the computer courses that I took, because I could probably write those things. And I ended up starting class at the age of 18 with credit or placement for 17 college courses. Thank you, just to my high school. I mean, just luck of the draw, right? Well, the weird thing was, after 2 quarters, you're already a junior. You're 18 years old. But the Navy gives you 4-year scholarship. So I kept taking classes, and eventually ended up finishing 3 different degrees. I graduated from the Arts and Sciences and Technology. If I was smart, I would have lined up and did like a bachelor's and then a master's. But I did all these things. And one of the things we did in the summer was 78 was had a chance to, like, I wanted to go to jump school because my dad was a paratrooper. Or my uncle was a paratrooper. Or my cousin was a paratrooper. And I was in the Navy. And so the Navy only got 80 slots per year to go ahead and go to jump school. I applied for the whole 56 colleges across the country, and I pushed and pushed and pushed. I finally convinced them to give me one, and I went through it. It was the toughest training of my life. Today, now, I look back at the physical training, it wasn't that bad, but back then, I had to push beyond my limitations. I remember seeing guys drop out that were on their high school and college football teams. They couldn't stand the mental stress. I could not fail, because if I didn't get my jump wings, how could I ever face my dad again? And what I found out is that it's like when you have this brick wall, it's all in your mind, and you run right at it, and you're going to hit it, and you go right through it. And your limitations in life are mostly up here. And what you need to learn to do is challenge your limitations. Those limitations, if you argue for them, are yours. And you can also make them go away. You all have unlimited potential. It's just we've never been trained that way. So we keep thinking that we've got to stay in a box somehow. So that was pretty cool. And so anyway, what I did is I went ahead, I finished my degrees, went off, spent 4 years in the Navy, actually 5 years in the Navy. I thought, this is pretty cool. I'm out here at sea. I'm traveling over the world. Here's a guy who never got on an airplane before he was 18. I'm in Hong Kong, Singapore, Thailand, buying all kinds of neat stuff, doing neat things, meeting interesting people, not killing them. You know, it's not what we did back then. But travel the whole world. It's like, whoa, all of a sudden, this is pretty neat. And I thought, well, maybe this would be nice to do. But the problem was is that I said I really wanted to go and work for NSA. Why do you think I like all this swag? Why do you think I have friends here from NSA? But it turned out that the Navy said, you shouldn't go to NSA. Well, why not? I know computers. I know security. I got a degree in math and computer science. And I ought to. Nope. If you, the Navy has no need for computer security. From Washington, 1984. Go back out to sea. Go to department head school or do something like that. Or go to ROTC and go teach school. I was like, no, I really want to do this. So I had a choice. I either go work for NSA for 3 years, and then my career would be over. I'd have to go find a job where I could learn how to get and do an end around. I remember sitting down in 1983 out at sea. I got one of these little books about how to organize your life, and I wrote down my goals. I wanted to own a computer security company. I wanted to do this, and I wanted to travel training. And I wrote it all down. It turned out, if you have a vision and you write it down, it works. All that stuff happened. And at the times of my life I had a written set of goals, I made the best progress in my life. Who here has a written set of goals that you've updated in the last 12 months? It's in writing. Yeah. Look around. 3%, 4%, 5%. All right. One of the studies I did, I think it was at Princeton University, I talked to a bunch of guys that graduated, all the graduating students age 22. 3% of them had written goals. They've tracked them throughout their careers. Around retirement, that 3% owned 97% of the wealth of all the class. Written goals work. They're huge. Okay, so anyway, I figured I could go to that, or I could go learn how to start my own business, and within 3 years, hire people out of a national security agency. So I went to work for Booz Allen for a year and a half, and then I went to work for a little startup company, and 2 years, 6 months later, I started National Security Corporation, which is where the company's name came from. I've been doing that for 21 years, and that's pretty cool. But one of the best things I learned when I was at Booz Allen is one of the older ladies, she had been almost 50, Lorena, and she told me something I always remembered, and I followed. She said, "Mark, speak every chance you can." What do I know about speaking? Speaking is the most terrible thing. More people are afraid of speaking than they are afraid of dying. But I started doing it. And the more I did it, the better I got at it. I had a chance to speak next to Admiral Grace Hopper. She was a keynote speaker. I was one of the warm-ups. I remember Admiral Grace Hopper. You ever seen a picture of her with the white hair and her unfiltered Camel cigarettes? Come here, young man. Gee, I wasn't even in uniform. You know, I was a lieutenant in the reserves at that point. I want you to make me a promise. And she points this unfiltered Camel at my nose. Yes, ma'am. I want you to promise me you're going to write an article on the value of information. Because she saw back in 1986 the value of information that we're seeing right now with identity theft and all the problems and compromises. And she said, someday you're going to see information on balance sheets. Well, I haven't actually technically written that article, although I've done 100 presentations. Maybe that's why I'm still alive, because I have to fulfill that promise to the Amazing Grace. But I do spend a lot of time telling people about stuff, and being able to speak helps, because it really makes it good. But the only problem is that when you start a business on your own, don't go it alone, because you don't have somebody else to cover for you. You got to do all the mail, and you got to do all the typing, you got to take out the trash, you got to make the coffee, and you got to go ahead and do all the accounting, you got to do the bill setting, and you spend huge percentage of your time thrashing. So pay someone else to play at what you got to work at. I didn't do that. I was a control freak, because I knew I could do it better than anybody else. And yeah, sure, I've done it better than anybody else, but it's still just me. 21 years later, I was in business before Symantec. I was in business before most of the major computer security companies, but I didn't grow it because I didn't know when to let go. I didn't know when to share. And so one of the things I did when I started my company is I had to make money. I had to do money any way I could. One of the things I found out is that cash flow was tough. In the first 4 months, I made $300. And the fifth month, I made $12,000 in 2 weeks. I thought, this rocks, because we actually landed a big client. But then I didn't see $1,500 a day for another 10 years. So for a while, you know, I was like hand to mouth. So, you know, what do you have to do? You got to be flexible. I was fixing pinball machines at the local mall to make a little bit of extra money, building it through the company so we chose some revenue for National Security Corporation. You secure pinball machines? Yes, we do. But it worked. And it helped. And it turned out later that speaking thing helped very much, because a couple of years ago, actually about 4 years ago, when I was doing more and more speaking, actually, you know, people say, how do you get paid to speak? I said, talk for free for 17 years. I did. 17 years I talked, never even knew anything about money. And finally, I kind of think, you know, I started doing better and better. I remember one conference, they said, congratulations, on the speaker feedback forms, you're ranked number one out of 122 speakers. Would you like to come back and do our keynote next year? It's like, this rocks. And then after 24 years, they stopped the conference. It was a computer security conference hosted by NSA and NIST, and they could not agree on the letterhead, who's going to have the name first, or who's got the bigger things, because these government bureaucrats, they shut it down. This thing had been going on since the early 70s. So here was my greatest chance to start them. So anyway, one of these conferences came along. I started doing a lot of stuff for MIS Training Institute, and they said, well, can you do this? No, I'm kind of busy. Well, I really want you to speak that. I didn't want to tell them, like, I didn't have a job at the time, and I didn't have any money, and I couldn't fly to San Francisco. And I said, nah. I said, well, we'll pay you. I go, what? You can get paid to speak? Yeah. And he's like, we'll pay you, like, $500. Like, you're on. So I started doing it for $500. Then I got my rate up to $800. I got up to $1,000. And, you know, now I'm trying to get back up to that $1,500 a day that I once got years and years ago. I got a phone call about 4 years ago from a friend of mine who worked for Cisco. Because I didn't realize what the market, I had no idea what things are worth. It was an imperfect economy. And he says, hey, G-Mark, I'm trying to get a hold of somebody else. You know his phone number. And looking up, he says, why? He says, because I need a speaker to do security. He says, that's what I do. At this point, I'll fix pinball machines again. He says, well, Rio, what are we doing? I says, well, we just bought a bunch of companies. We need someone to go ahead and give these talks to all of our clients in the Chicago area, in the Midwest area. We've got to do 8 different talks. And I said, well, yeah, I can do that. I says, what does it pay? He says, well, we had a guy here from Storage Technology, and he charges $8,000. I'm thinking, like, okay, $8,000, 8 cities, $1,000 a day if they cover expenses. Well, it's not too bad. So I kind of say, like, okay, so that's $8,000 for them. I says, no, that's per city. Okay, calm down. What the next words out of my mouth were the following. Sometimes I go that low. I don't know where that came from. But I said, you're a friend, I can do it for $7,000. And he said, I'll tell you what, I'll tell him that you wanted 10 grand, I got you down to 7,500, then I'll look like a hero. It's like my kind of hero. So all of a sudden, after 17 years of speaking for nothing, I found out that there's a huge value in being articulate, by being able to communicate at a level that makes sense to a wide range of audiences, and most specifically executive audiences, because they don't get it. They don't get bits. They don't get bites. And we lose it in the translation. And so I was very fortunate, and he warned me. He says, Mark, you do well. They're going to keep inviting you back. Oh, no. $500,000 in speaking fees later. Helps Cisco take their $300 million investment and put it into warp speed. The first executive seminar we did, we got $2 million in sales. I said, can I get a commission? No, we're getting a flat rate. You know what? That flat rate was still pretty good. It was hugely successful for Cisco. It was hugely successful for me. Think win-win, but you know what? Go ahead and aim high. Because if I had thought I wanted $1,000, I'd say, no, he's not in the right class. Because I know as a professional speaker, and I do this a lot. This is pretty much how I feed my family, is getting up in front of a podium. And I get over these fear of being in front of people, because you get over that if you're ever worried about that. I was talking to a friend who's like, I had to do my talk yesterday with like this all the time. It's like, your message is important. Pick someone in the audience if you have to. Go make eye contact. Talk to that one person, but say, what I'm saying, sharing for you is valuable. You're here because you're looking for something of value. That empowers you. That keeps you going. And that's pretty cool. And one of the things I found out about that is you got to really love what you're doing. You got to be passionate about that. If you lose your emotions, if you lose that drive, life gets very bland. Because as a kid, I always liked Mr. Spock. He was smart, the scientist. I remember sitting in front of the bathroom mirror at the age of 9, trying to learn how to raise an eyebrow and then the other eyebrow. I could never twitch my nose, so I knew I wouldn't make it as a witch. But I could be a Vulcan. And in naming for the acerbic, emotionless life state, it turns out that if you turn off your emotions, you turn off the leverage you have to make changes in your life. It's a very powerful thing. We guys aren't always very much in touch with our emotions, but it's very important. Because there's a lot of stuff out there, and we get excited about things. We go, whoa, look at this. This is fun. Hey, this is a great job offer. And so you go off and you take a great job offer. And then someone else says, hey, how would you like to work on this project? Okay, that looks pretty good. How'd you like that? And guess what? Beware of bright, shiny objects. You never outgrow them. They get more expensive. They get shinier. But you don't outgrow them. And so here's the thing. You need to have that vision thing again. Where do you want to go? Because while I was doing that 3 years trying to ramp up to start my own little company, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And I had plenty of job offers to go work for other Beltway Bandits in Washington, D.C., making a little bit more money than I was making at Booz Allen, but I wasn't interested. I didn't want to go work for somebody else. I wanted to run my own business, and that focus kept me going. And I got it on schedule, and I started my first business when I was age 29. And I still own the business. I also still own my first car. Okay, maybe it's a Buffalo thing, a pack rat, but it's a cool car, and I just finished restoring it. It's a 1960 Corvette. I didn't sell mine. Now, when I got married, that first year, the wife said, what are you going to do with that stupid old dumb car? Why don't you sell and buy some furniture? I said, honey, the only reason I would ever sell that car is to pay for a divorce attorney. Now, does that explain how I feel about it? That Corvette rocks. I love it. Even 25 years later, you just get in there. You don't even have to drive fast. Because you figure in today's years, that's like buying a 1983 Corvette, right? Wrong! There are no 1983 Corvettes. It was a trick question. But it was 25 years old, 23 years old. So anyway, you figure car 85, 84 isn't all that old today. But when you get older, it's a pretty cool classic. And so it's pretty neat. So we got to be aware of that. And the other thing is when you pick out your bright, shiny objects and you weave your way through that minefield, make a choice. You see, I stayed in the Navy Reserve. And I liked that. I had a chance to serve. I thought that was very important. Because I wanted to do something that was bigger than myself. And I found out that over the years, it's really been important for me because, A, it's a chance to give back. They gave me a chance I never had. That was to go to Northwestern University and go to a real college and get some good education from it. Plus, it was a chance because I really enjoyed working with the people. And I get a chance to share, and you get responsibilities, and they put you in command. Command is pretty cool. It's the best job you can get in the military. And I've been very, very privileged. I've had 8 command tours. And that is probably why I haven't focused on growing my business, because I was getting my leadership fixed in the Navy. And more importantly, last year or 2 years ago, they gave me a chance to be commanding officer of the whole Center for Naval Leadership, running leadership training for the whole Navy Reserve, 65,000 people. That rocks. Because now you can see all the things that were wrong, everything that was screwed up, that bugged you, and now you're in a position to fix it. But you got to go sleeper for 25 years. You got to put up with the crap. You got to put up with the hassle until you finally get to the point where you're senior than everybody else and say, this is how we're going to do it. We are not going to screw with our people. We're not going to lie to them. We're not going to take advantage of them. We're going to do positive leadership. We're going to make it work. And so that to me was really, really important, and I thought that was great. But the thing was, is I tried to do a technology company, but I want to do the leadership thing. But I want to do both. Well, the problem is, and I talk over with Marcus Random, and he'll tell you the same thing. You need to make a choice. You got to be tech or you got to be management. If you try to do both, it's like trying to, like, do I take the exit? Do I go on this highway? Do I take the exit? Go on the highway. All of a sudden, boom, you hit that little divide, boom, 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 and all the water and the sand comes out of your stuff. So what do we do? My thought was, is that, hey, I love the technology stuff. I haven't forgotten it. All the principles are the same. I was talking to Lost yesterday. He's saying, like, okay, T-Mark, come over here. I said, what? Okay, we're like 5 hours into our contest right now, and they haven't figured out this one thing. I said, what is it? He said, well, one of the clues is that we got to go ahead and you have a crypto field that's immune to to frequency analysis. What would you think it would be? One-time pad. He said, they've been working 5 hours trying to solve that, in 15 seconds. Well, yeah. But you've been doing it your whole life. And it's not against anybody else spending the 5 hours to figure it out, because I'll tell you what, back in the 70s, it would have taken me 5 hours to figure it out. But once you learn this stuff, it's very valuable. But the trick is, if you learn it, but if you can't communicate it effectively to the decision makers, who cares? The decision makers, the people who got their MBAs, which is very useful, by the way. When I got my MBA, you figure, okay, what's it going to cost you? $39,000 in tuition. This was 10 years ago. How long after graduation before I made that much money back? It turned out it was 7 months. Not that I made it in those 7 months, but I took a job change in the middle. I went back to work for someone for a while, negotiated a 50% raise. I made 200 stock options at Accent in 2 years. I got $15,000 from Secure Computing. And all of a sudden, there was real money. And all of a sudden, when you add all that up, and I was getting $1,000 a year from Accent, and they said, hey, we'll give you $4,000 a year. And oh, by the way, since I joined the company in December, I said, give me this year and next year, so I got $8,000 there. And it turned out that 7 months after graduation, I'd recaptured all the money. That's a good return on investment. And it's also allowed me to go ahead and do the Cisco thing and speak to executives in a plausible, meaningful thing where I explain information in terms of total cost of ownership and litigation avoidance. And what does it look in terms of asset management? All the things that they're going to make their decision criteria, you need to learn that language if you're going to be effective. Otherwise, we play in the technology area. We have a lot of fun with it. But we're not able to influence the flow of money or the flow of decisions. And so that's a very, very important thing to do. So one of the things I want to suggest to you is you want to do something bigger than yourself. Don't just do it all for you. Don't just take the money and then keep it all. Give stuff away. It's good to give things away. People appreciate it. You know what? It's not all that bad. And you find out the stuff you give away, if you don't give it away during your lifetime, someone else is going to give it away when you die. Right? Think about it. You don't live forever, unfortunately. We got a TTL that's a hidden field in life. And for all your lamers out there, it's time to live. Hey, number 063, are you here? Doc, he's not awake yet. Just be glad I wasn't throwing out like a coin or something like that. This guy would be suing me. Any lawyers here? Okay. But do something bigger than yourself. And, important thing is, here's what I consider an important recipe for life. Have a vision. See that thing again? Why? Vision is important. Lao Tse, Chinese philosopher, said, without vision, the people perish. But you could take the word the out of there. Without vision, people perish. Without vision, you perish. You don't succeed. You don't achieve in life. If you're not part of your own plan for life, you're part of somebody else's. And if you're an employee of a company, I ask people, I said that, what company do you work for? How much is the founder of that company making from you working for him? If you work for Microsoft, does Bill Gates make money on you? Yeah. How hard does he have to work to keep you going? He doesn't. Be the founder. Best title to have is majority shareholder. Because what you're doing is you're building an engine that goes ahead and creates things, but create something bigger than yourself and do it for positive purposes. Another thing, have a plan. Have a plan to know a strategy to get you there. From where I was as a naval officer floating around at sea, wondering what I want to do and what the real world's like, to then going ahead 3 years later and having my own business and hanging out my shingle and doing that stuff was because I made a plan, I wrote it down, I committed to it, I executed on that. And you got to keep doing it. You got to keep updating your plans. And you get a little bit lazy about that sometimes. And I'll confess, I don't have my written plan right now. I have what I call a week in the woods. And my week in the woods, I first did there back in 1987 when I went up to Maine with an older guy in his 50s. I said, Mark, let me take you up there, and we're going to go bear hunting. It's like, okay. He says, but I don't own a rifle. He says, we don't use rifles. We use revolvers. So we went down to the store, no 10-day waiting period back then, picked out a nice Ruger Super Red Hawk, 7.5-inch barrel, 44 caliber, big honking gun. Said, wait, it's not ready. You got to have it magnaported. Pretty cool thing. A little company cuts trapezoidal ports at the end, so a 44, you fire that thing. The recoil, you're back here. And if you're about as light as I am, you're like two rows back. But with a magnaport, what happens is the recoil, the little jet exhaust comes up, it counteracts, it just comes right back almost like a recoilless rifle so you can stay on target. Which, if you got a 300-pound bear coming at you at warp 9, it really helps to get a second shot off. And you got a little scope on there, so it looks pretty cool. Little aim point, little red dot in there. Ooh, doesn't project, but you see it in there. A little swivel because it's 5.5 pounds. You got to carry it on your shoulder like a rifle. And we hit the woods. And 1 week of no phones, no fax, no email. Of course, there wasn't a whole lot back then, but there was some. Just time to settle down. But more importantly, I didn't see a bear. I didn't shoot at a bear. I didn't really want to shoot at a bear because they told bears taste pretty lousy. They're like greasy, grimy pork. But I'll tell you what, when you're walking around the woods carrying a .44 instead of a walking stick, you're a predator. You own anything that moves. and you spend a week owning anything that moves, trying to think about what you want to do with your life, you get control back. Take that week in the woods. Shut off the phone. Don't worry about not getting paid. Take a week of unpaid leave if you have to. If you're not sure where your life is going, go out and spend a little bit of time on your own. Ideally, do it with someone a little bit older who's a good mentor, so you don't have to make the mistakes, and figure out where you want to go. Take that plan. Then don't take a risk. When I started my company, I kind of figured, like, wait a minute, I've always had a paycheck. And now I got to let go of that paycheck and go start on my own. Well, you don't have one. Have I ever started a business before? A few of us have, okay? Anybody still in that same business? All right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 out of about 300. It's tough. High failure rates. And what I figured is it's like holding onto a rope in a totally dark room and someone said, let go of the rope and fall to the floor. No, Lord, I wonder what I'm going to die. I'm going to fall. It's going to be crying. It's terrible. It's 50 feet. It's going to be like. That's it. That's it. You were 2 inches off the ground the whole time. You can always go back to work for somebody else. You don't need a factory. You need a box of business cards and a laptop. And you are in business. Give it a try. If it doesn't work, go back and work for somebody. But take a risk, and you'll find out that once you know that you can survive on your own, it gives you an entirely different degree of freedom that most people never achieve in life. And then stay focused. Remember that TDL thing? You don't know how much time you've got. Keep working on the goal. Avoid those bright, shiny objects. What helps you avoid the bright, shiny object is that written set of goals, that life plan that says, I want this, not that, not whatever. Because there are interesting things out there. And like most of us who have ADD in this world of computer security, you're very attracted to those bright, shiny objects, but this helps you stay focused. If the bright, shiny object is in your line of vision, you do it. If it's not, stay away from it. There'll be more. Achieve your stuff first. And then lastly, stick to it. You will encounter difficulties. Difficulties are always part of life. They're there to see how badly you want something. Okay, how badly do you want to be in your own business? Do you give up when you stop making money? How badly do you want to be in a relationship? Do you give up after your first argument? How badly do you want to succeed in life? How badly do you want to make a difference in your life? You want to end up just some anonymous face end up there joining AARP saying, I want my free money. Or you want to be in a position where you're financially independent at that age. And you can make the choices that you want. And you can create opportunities for others because the company you built created employment opportunities for folks who have families and their kids will be supported from that money that is generated from your vision and your idea that made a difference in the world. And so when you do all this stuff, don't save your best for last. You might not get there. That's an error I make. I figure I got forever. Most people are more afraid of speaking than dying. Of course, I don't even think about dying, but you ought to. Hey, 50. Eventually, it's going to get you. What's your legacy? All the stuff I want to do, all the things I haven't written down, the books I haven't published yet, even though I got the domain name and the ISBN and everything else ready to go, but I haven't gotten around to it. One of these days, life's going to come along and say, game over. Just like that little Altair when they throw the switch, all that volatile memory goes away. We haven't figured out a way to save you to disk yet. And until we do, you've got to make sure that you get everything out into the output buffer as fast as you can figure it out, and make it count, and make it good. And be generous now, as I said, because someone else is going to give away your stuff. You can't take it with you. No U-Hauls behind a hearse, at least not that I've seen. So have fun with life. And one last thought here. In the hacker community, what I've seen is the biggest disparity I've ever run into in terms of intelligence and economic success. Why is that? This room has some of the smartest people in America, actually probably from around the world. And yet financially, some of the folks out here are destitute. And guys that I know who barely have any money. Why? In my opinion, it's like a dream. Anybody remember reading Neuromancer, William Gibson? How do you define the internet? A consensual hallucination. Sounds like a good Hacker Jeopardy final answer. A consensual hallucination. It's not real. Did you ever have a dream where you found money laying around? It's pretty cool. Did you ever wake up with it in your hand? No, it's a hallucination. Unless you can transform what is in the net into reality, it doesn't count. It's not the silicon network in life that counts. It's the carbon network that counts. It's the people in your lives. Those are the persistent objects. Those are the things that you need to make sure that you take care of, you learn to know how to love, to have a relationship, to go ahead and make a difference in life. Because here's a little thought problem for you. You need to enjoy life. You only get one trip at it. But imagine that you can't travel back in time. You're not allowed to today, but perhaps someday in the future you are. And here's a thought I'd like to leave you with. You come back from 40 years from now, and you had one chance to come back at a point in your life, and the guys who run the time machine said, well, you know, we got to send you back now because you got this terminal illness. You're going to be dead in 2 days, so we got to send you now. We don't have time to perfect the technology so we can get you back to 2008. That's the good news. The bad news is you remember none of this. You don't have any of the wisdom. You don't have any of the memories. Nothing. You've got to do it over again. It's a polite way of saying at the end of my time. But let me finish the analogy. It's only 1 minute longer. But all you have is in the back of your mind. See, that was a time machine. It just warped you back. All you know is you just came back from 40 years from now to here because you had to make a change in your life. You knew that this point in life was an inflection point where you had a key decision coming up that if you went a little bit different way, if you wrote down your vision, if you wrote down your goals, if you executed, your whole life would evolve completely differently so that 40 years from now you're exactly where you want to be, your loving life. Think carefully about what your life is all about, what you can do with it, and the change you want to make so you can go forward and be successful. Have fun. Have great. I hope you all live past 50 to 100. I hope this is really halftime, and I'll see you again in 50 years. Take care.